On October 3, 1980, a bomb was detonated outside a synagogue on Köpernick Street in Paris. 3 decades later, French investigators finally identified a suspect in the case. A Lebanese-Canadian sociology professor living a quiet life on the outskirts of Ottawa, Canada. Is Hassan Diab guilty?
Can you introduce yourself?
Or is he a scapegoat?
Hassan Diab.
From Canada Land, this is The Köpernick Affair. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ecuador has a national election this weekend, and the rise in violent crime is a huge issue for voters.
That has been mostly driven by a massive expansion of the cocaine trade through Ecuador.
I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. What's at stake as Ecuadorians go to the polls and the U.S. security contractors on the ground in the Gaza Strip?
It's a fragile time in Gaza, and these are American contractors, and they may be targeted as well.
Plus, deportation flights to Latin America are angering U.S. trading partners in the region. And we look back at a scientific breakthrough from one century ago that upended our understanding of where early humans come from.
It was important because at the time there hadn't been any early human ancestors at all found in Africa.
All those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. We're starting today in Ecuador, where voters will head to the polls this weekend for general elections. There are plenty of issues on people's minds as they think about who to vote for.
But the biggest one is probably the explosion of violent crime that's plagued Ecuador in recent years. International drug gangs have upended this once peaceful nation, driving tens of thousands of people to flee to the U.S. and elsewhere. The World's Latin America correspondent, Tibisa Isaiah, reports on what's at stake in this election.
Voters in Ecuador are concerned about the cost of living, the lack of jobs, and frequent blackouts. But according to polls, nothing worries them more than the rise of violent crime.
Soy Ricardo Espinel. Guayaquil siempre ha sido una ciudad sumamente alegre, una ciudad costera.
Ricardo Espinel is a resident of Guayaquil. That's a city on the Pacific coast of Ecuador that, he says, used to be a fun and vibrant place close to the beach.
Lo que vivimos ha sido un ambiente de terror. Todos estos sicariatos, estos asesinatos.
Now, he says, people live under an atmosphere of terror.
Se ven cosas muy crudas. Una persona que estaba embalada, llena de cinta y con explosivos.
He describes recent incidents involving hostages wrapped in explosives, car bombings, kidnappings, and assassinations.
Pero nunca antes visto.
Something, he says, he had not seen before. Ecuador used to be a relatively peaceful country. But in recent years, homicide rates have quadrupled. Last year, the country became the number one exporter of cocaine from Latin America to Europe.
That has been mostly driven by a massive expansion of the cocaine trade through Ecuador and the different disputes between criminal gangs trying to get a share of that business.
Sebastián Hurtado is a political risk analyst in Ecuador. He says transnational criminal organizations from Mexico and Colombia have established operations there, taking advantage of weak institutions and borders, and recruiting teenagers in marginalized neighborhoods.
Nuestro objetivo ha sido empezar a construir un país donde la tranquilidad y el progreso.
Daniel Noboa, the current president, took office in a snap election just 18 months ago. He's taking a hard line against criminal groups, deploying the military and expanding their role. Homicides fell by 16% during his term, but the security crisis is far from resolved. On Sunday, Noboa faces the polls once more. There are 15 other candidates, but he's the front runner.
What is at stake in this election is the possibility of electing a government that can remain in power for at least 4 years.
That's Sebastián Hurtado again.
And that's because for the past 7 years, we've been living through interim governments that have struggled to survive and have not been able to advance significant reforms.
Noboa's biggest competition is Luisa Gonzalez. She has focused her campaign on nostalgia for her party's years in power under former President Rafael Correa. He was a leftist populist who is now in exile, convicted of corruption. But Gonzalez's association with Correa has also limited her appeal.
Ahora, yo siento que a ellos les juega justamente la historia, lamentablemente.
Koya Shuguli, an indigenous politician in Quito, the capital, says Gonzalez and her party are associated with some negative history. She has trouble supporting her, even though she would love to see a woman winning the presidency in Ecuador. Shuguli is also not happy with President Noboa's approach to crime, so she will be voting for a third-party candidate. Elections are on Sunday, and if none of the candidates secures over 50% of the vote, there will be a runoff in April. But a recent poll shows Noboa with a large enough lead to win in the first round. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isea.
Israelis have been treated to scenes of joy in recent days. Keith Siegel, an American Israeli, was one of the hostages released in an exchange last week. This video, released by Israeli authorities, shows Keith Siegel's family greeting and embracing him for the first time. This moment marks a shift in the lives of the hostage families, of course, but also Israeli society in general. Emily Wesolowski is Keith Siegel's niece. We reached her in Washington. She spoke about the moment Siegel reunited with his wife Aviva in Israel.
He saw Aviva and his oldest child, his son Shai. It was absolutely incredible to see the smile on Aviva's face. I have not seen her smile like that since before October 7th, and it was just absolutely amazing to see. And Shai, their oldest son, who also lived on Kibbutz Kfar Aza, he was hiding in his bomb shelter on October 7th. And so when Keith and Aviva were taken hostage by Hamas, they did not know what the fate of their son was. So to see Keith reunited first with Aviva and Shai was just, it's hard to put into words how amazing and incredible it was.
Now, President Trump has made some radical new statements about what should happen in Gaza, namely to move the Palestinian population out and rebuild it. Those are not terms in the current ceasefire deal. How much do you worry that this sudden shift could jeopardize the return of the rest of the hostages?
There are more phases that are still part of this agreement, and that is what needs to be the focus right now. Myself, my family is so incredibly grateful to President Trump, to the Trump administration, for bringing this ceasefire agreement over the finish line. You know, we now get to see and hug Keith, and we really need President Trump to continue to pressure Bibi Netanyahu and Hamas to see this ceasefire agreement through to its full implementation. That is the first priority as I see it.
And as I understand it, that was one of the first things Keith said after he was released.
He said, "What can I do to help bring home the rest of the hostages?"
What do we know now about the conditions under which your uncle was held hostage by Hamas?
When Keith was released, he looks incredibly thin and pale. He was given very, very little food, maybe one half of a pita a day, or maybe a half of a pita twice a day. He was kept in tunnels, inside of houses. You know, he looks incredibly pale. There were times, many times, when he was forced to lie down and he was not allowed to sit up.
Emily, how has your uncle's kidnapping changed you?
It has been so hard to just breathe normally, to think about anything else. Just every waking minute of every day, I have spent thinking about both Keith and Aviva, and then thinking about Keith wondering where he is, what conditions he's being held. It's very difficult to continue on with, quote, you know, normal life. What does that even mean? And also, given that I live in the U.S., you know, to be so far away from the family has been difficult, to say the least.
Emily Wasilowski is Keith Siegel's niece. Siegel was one of the Israeli hostages held by Hamas, who was released last week during the ongoing ceasefire process.
President Trump's comments earlier this week about the U.S. taking control over the Gaza Strip got a lot of attention. When asked later to clarify his plans, the president did not rule out deploying American forces. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt also said this about sending U.S. service members into Gaza.
The president has not committed to putting boots on the ground in Gaza. He has also said that the United
States... There is, however, a group of Americans currently on the ground in the Palestinian territory. They're employed by private security companies and tasked with guarding a strategic area in Gaza. The World's Shirin Jafari has been reporting on this. Shirin, who are these companies operating in Gaza?
We know of two American companies that are currently operating inside Gaza. One is called UG Solutions. The other is called Safe Reach Solutions. UG Solutions is based in North Carolina and Safe Reach is based in Wyoming. The U.S. government isn't giving us much information about these companies. The State Department didn't respond to my questions about them. Their websites seem to have been very quickly put together. There isn't much history or background on them. I reached out to both companies. They didn't respond to my questions. But from what we've been able to gather, the people who work for these companies are likely people who served in the U.S. military in the past. The Washington Post reported that they're being paid about $1,000 a day and they get $10,000 advance pay for their work in Gaza.
And what are these security contractors doing in Gaza? What is their role there?
They're responsible for manning checkpoints, checking vehicles, for weapons, and just making sure there's order. I spoke with one Gaza resident about this, and he said, yes, he has seen them operating on the ground. They're armed, obviously. Then I asked him how he feels about these Americans being on the ground in Gaza. And he said, you know, we don't really have much say in this, so we are just going with it.
Shirin, do you know how many of these contractors are on the ground in Gaza right now?
This is not a large number of forces on the ground.
Okay, and they're basically working alongside Israeli military members at these checkpoints?
The Israeli military is not working directly with them, but they are still on the ground.
So Israel says it has security control over Gaza and that Hamas will not be allowed to return. So who do these private security forces report to? Is it Israel?
I spoke with Sean McFaith, who teaches at the National Defense University in Washington, about this. He used to work for private security companies himself. He worked in Africa and other places. And he said he also hasn't heard of these companies.
My guess is that the United States government is paying for these contractors. They're U.S. contractors. And frankly, let's be honest, much of what Israel is doing, America's paying a hefty part of that.
Again, no confirmation of this by the State Department, but it's important for the public to know that these Americans are on the ground in Gaza.
Private security contractors operating abroad don't have always the best reputation. I'm thinking of Blackwater in Iraq, for example. In this case, do you have any idea what happens if something goes wrong?
Yeah, these companies have a complicated history. Like you said, in Iraq, Blackwater operators shot and killed a group of Iraqi civilians in 2007. McFaith told me that these companies are used by a whole range of different actors. Governments use them, oil and gas companies use them. Basically, anybody who has money can hire these private forces now. As for what happens if something goes wrong, here's what he said.
Both Israel government and the American governments can sort of try to walk it back and say, it was this ridiculous company. We're so sorry. Here's some money. We won't hire them again. So it gives a little bit of political latitude to the client.
I should point out, Carolyn, that despite the temporary ceasefire that's in place in Gaza, the situation remains fragile. We know that Hamas is still in control and has even managed to recruit new members. And they likely see these Americans as intruders carrying out the work of their enemy.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you for reporting on this.
You're welcome, Carolyn.
You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. 100 years ago today, a scientific paper upended conventional understanding of where human ancestors evolved. Pointing to a newly discovered fossil, anthropologist Raymond Dart argued that humanity's evolutionary path began in Africa. Rebecca Rogers Ackerman knows the history of this discovery and the controversy it caused very well. She is co-director of the Human Evolution Research Institute in Cape Town, South Africa.
It was important because at the time there hadn't been any early human ancestors at all found in Africa. And so when he announced the discovery of Australopithecus africanus, he announced the discovery of the Taung child and named it that new species. It was the first time that anyone had made any real claims that human origins had started on the African continent. So it was revolutionary at the time and led to not immediately, but eventually led to a fundamental shift in terms of how paleoanthropology thought about human origins happening in an African context.
So just tell us a little bit about the discovery and the fossil that Dart described and put into the scientific record in the journal Nature back 100 years ago today.
So it was discovered at a lime, what we call a lime works in Buxton by miners. We don't actually know who made the discovery because this was, of course, in the 1920s. It was in a South African context. There was quite a lot of racism at the time. The workers were black who would have been working in that context. And so we don't actually know who the discoverer was exactly. But we do know that eventually those fossils, through various means, made it to Raymond Dart, who was a professor, an Australian professor, who was at the University of the Witwatersrand in South Africa. And he's the one who recognized it for what it was and made the announcement by publishing it in the journal Nature on exactly this day, 100 years ago.
You mentioned that eventually it upended our understanding of human evolution, but what was the reaction from scientists at the time?
At the time, in 1925, the world, if you will, the Western, largely male, largely white scientific world, was pointing towards a Eurasian origin for humans. And so when Dart announced this discovery, it was within that context. And it was also, if you can think about the 1920s, it was also very much a context of scientific racism that was happening as well. And so it didn't go down well, despite the fact that Darwin had, you know, many, many years before said that Africa was a good place to look for human origins. It still didn't go down well in terms of kind of where people's heads were and where they were thinking that humans should be originating from. So there was a lot of pushback.
We've talked about how this news was received through the lens of racism, who did and didn't get credit for this work. I'm curious, looking back through the lens of history, how much you think this field has changed in the last 100 years.
Yeah, it hasn't changed as much as we would like. I mean, the reality is that helicopter research, and that's a term that refers to people kind of quote unquote helicoptering in, you know, flying in from overseas and doing research and then taking fossils or taking their data and leaving again and analyzing them back overseas is quite common in Africa. And the kind of acknowledgement of this and realization of how common it is has become much more widespread, but only fairly recently. And so we now look around at the discipline and realize that for almost 100 years, the discipline of paleoanthropology has been, you know, largely run by foreigners and white people in an African context. And that's really a problem. It has changed a bit, and it is changing a bit. But, you know, large research teams are still not largely run by Africans, large international research teams. First authorship on really high-profile papers are still not largely by Africans. And so, you know, the discipline hasn't changed as much as we would like it to. And that's really important. You know, I know there are a lot of issues going on in the U.S. right now and about diversity and equity and inclusion, but it's way beyond that because this is really about good science. You know, we know, and there have been many studies that have been done about how diverse teams produce better science because they have insights into things that are diverse in terms of the backgrounds that they're coming from. And unfortunately, you know, we haven't had enough of that within an African paleoanthropological context. We really need more.
So 100 years on from this very important discovery, today, what are the biggest questions about human origins that experts are still asking and are still focused on learning more about?
Yeah, there are a lot of them. You know, one of the interesting things about these early hominins in particular is that, you know, we still don't really know. I mean, we know eventually it led to us, right? But we still don't really fully understand how they related to each other. And so, you know, unpacking that involves finding a lot more fossils, obviously, doing a lot more research to discover these wonderful resources. But it also involves new techniques like ancient DNA, ancient paleoproteomics, to try to really unpack the relationships among them. So, you know, we tend to look at this, if you Google, you know, human evolution, you'll see this little linear thing that goes from an early ape-like thing, and it's just like walking people, right? And ends with a...
I'm picturing the bumper sticker.
You can see it, right? And it ends with usually a man. And that's not the way evolution works, you know? And it's not even a branching tree, the way evolution works, that we've often been taught about to kind of counteract that. It's much more of a braided stream. And so understanding these relationships among the hominins is, it's an ongoing science, and understanding how they met and interacted and maybe even merged in certain contexts, because we know that hybridization occurred in the past. We know that from Neanderthals. That's really a direction that there's just so much more work to be done in.
Rebecca Rogers-Ackerman is co-director of the Human Evolution Research Institute in Cape Town, South Africa.
Rue, spelled R-U-E, is an herb you may not be familiar with. It's been used in parts of Europe for centuries, often in sauces to help balance flavors.
In Poland, for a long time, it had an unsavory association. It was said to be used by witches to poison their victims.
Women were even executed for using it. Well, now the all-female band Pokey wants to flip that narrative. Their tune, Rutka, celebrates women and freedom of choice. Chciałam serutki na cztery ogródki, na piątym
barwinku, na ciebie jasienku. These lyrics describe a woman who plants the herb while waiting for love. That love doesn't end up arriving, but she finds happiness anyway in freedom from marriage and motherhood.
For some, it's like a curse that's been broken.
More stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World.
If you're nervous about bursting into song all by yourself, the Germans have a tradition of getting together in a big crowd and just letting loose.
Enjoying the vibe with everybody else and, like, yeah, not being embarrassed to sing. I think that's maybe part of it.
The sing-along where participation is the point, with no judgment. That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Syria, the former Assad regime's prisons were synonymous with two things: torture and killing.
This was documented over the years by activists and international human rights organizations. But one Syrian man who put a vivid spotlight on what occurred inside those prisons was known simply as Caesar.
He worked as a military photographer and provided photographic evidence of many atrocities. Yesterday, in a TV interview, he finally revealed his true identity, Farid Nada Al-Madan.
To learn more about his story, we reached out to Muaz Mustafa. He's the director of the Syrian Emergency Task Force, a Washington-based NGO that was created in 2011 to support the Syrian opposition. And Mustafa spent a lot of time with Farid Nada Al-Madan.
You know, when he first came out, he was mostly thinking about the families who had lost loved ones or who were missing loved ones that had been tortured to death by the Assad regime, and thought how important it was to be able to, you know, let them know, let them have closure. And as time went on, he became really key in understanding that this file and what he has witnessed is something that the world needs to know. When I met Caesar, I already had a full understanding of his background, that this was a defector from the regime, that he was a military police photographer. I had already seen the file itself, you know, the almost 55,000 photos and command responsibility documents that he had brought pictures of out. We always knew that, you know, his identity had to stay hidden for security reasons. And then he took on, you know, the code name Caesar.
So what are in these photographs, these many photographs that he brought out and showed you?
So they represent a snapshot in both time and geography. So only in Damascus, and only from 2011 to 2013. But in that time period alone, Caesar had brought out and collected almost 55,000 photos that showed thousands of men, women, children, elderly, Arabs, Kurds, Christians, Alawites, Sunnis. I mean, the whole mosaic of the Syrian people, these civilians, tortured in the most horrific ways, using electrocution, pulling out fingernails, the gouging out of eyes, emaciated bodies. I mean, just unimaginable horrors in the way that they were killed, in the way that they were executed. And you see in these photos this machinery of death. Later on, we found out they all ended up in mass graves, but at that point, we didn't know. But it showed how horrific the machinery of death of the Assad regime was, and that the worst crimes of the 21st century were unfolding in Syria as the world watched.
Now, I think you answered my next question, but he was a military photographer, so are all these photos ones he had to take in his job?
Yeah, absolutely. So Caesar, before the beginning of the revolution, he worked as a military police photographer in an area called Kabun, a neighborhood in Damascus. And when the revolution began, he was asked to go to a military hospital to document instances of death. Now, the way it's presented, it's like someone had a car accident or cardiac arrest or something else or a suicide. But when he went to the military hospital, he saw that it was just civilians. He was required by the state to take four photos of each body, attach them to a report that went up the sort of military judicial system under the Assad regime. So these were documented on behalf of the state.
So the West first saw these photos in 2014. Did they have any effect on policy towards Syria by the U.S. or anyone else?
So there was definitely a lot of outrage from policymakers to the public to whoever saw them. But the action, in my opinion, was too little for what we were showing, right? I mean, we were showing that, you know, every day people are being tortured to death in concentration camps, in dungeons, in horrible prisons, including children, you know, and the world didn't do enough. But the effect of his testimonies multiple times and the Caesar photos being, you know, we did exhibits all around the world, from parliaments to universities to schools to Congress, did have an effect. And in 2014, we had organized a hearing for Caesar. As I mentioned, SETF brought Caesar about six times to the United States. And on the first time, we did a hearing before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And in that hearing, we managed to be able to put up those photos as large poster boards, some of these photos all around the members. And I remember, you know, I was the translator as Caesar testified during that hearing. And I remember all these members were just looking in awe and silently at what they were seeing. And regardless of Republican or Democrat, they all wanted to do something about it. And that was actually the beginning of something called the Caesar Syria Civilian Protection Act, which ended up passing both the House and Senate and being signed into law, and played an important role in cutting the revenue streams off the Assad regime, who was waging war against his own people.
Do you know why Fareed is going public now with his real identity?
Assad's gone, Russia's gone, Iran's gone, Hezbollah's gone, all of these things that were in Syria, you know, the intelligence branches of the Assad regime that tortured all these people, that threatened, you know, anyone that spoke out against it, are no longer there, thank God. And today, Syria's safe. It needs a lot of work. There's a lot of, you know, rebuilding that must happen. It has been, you know, devastated by this long war. But, you know, what put fear in a lot of people and all of that is gone now. With the Assad regime leaving, I would expect a lot of these key witnesses, Caesar, the gravedigger, those that worked on the mass graves, others will make their identities public, and they can now not live with fear anymore, but can tell the story of what happened to Syria. And hopefully, and I know at least as far as Caesar and SETF are concerned, do everything we can to ensure that now all sanctions are lifted off of Syria as it forges its way to becoming the first Arab democracy, in my opinion.
Have you talked to Fareed since he revealed his actual identity?
So I spoke to him today, actually. So he's a little bit overwhelmed because, like, everyone is, you know, messaging him as they're finding out that he's Caesar. But it's so weird, like, calling him Fareed a bunch of times today with you. I almost forgot his name was Fareed. I called him Caesar so much, even to his face, even when we were alone, just to keep it a practice. Very proud to have worked with him and very proud to see someone like Fareed can inspire others, that anyone can make a difference. One person can. And he did.
Muaz Mustafa is the director of the Syrian Emergency Task Force, an NGO in Washington that was founded in 2011 to support the Syrian opposition.
It's part of fulfilling a key campaign promise. The Trump administration is touting its use of military flights to deport migrants to Latin America. The overall number of deportation flights from the U.S. has not increased, but countries in the region are angry over how migrants are now being treated, and that could have an impact on trade relations. From Colombia, reporter Manuel Rueda has the story.
Nelson Ardila arrived in Bogota's airport last week with his belongings stuffed into a plastic bag. He was flown in from Texas on a deportation flight run by a U.S. contractor. We were put in handcuffs during the whole flight, Ardila says. The treatment was very inhumane. Like most of the people on that flight, Ardila didn't have a criminal record in the U.S. or in Colombia. He had crossed the border illegally on January 20th, however, and turned himself into authorities in an effort to seek asylum. Ardila says that he was taken to a detention center. There's always a light on, so you could barely sleep there, he says. He was deported 8 days later. President Trump has promised to increase deportation flights to Colombia and other Latin American countries as he tries to crack down on illegal immigration. But these flights are now creating tensions with some Latin American nations, whose presidents have complained about how their citizens have been treated. In Colombia, President Gustavo Petro recently said that he wouldn't accept deportation flights from the Trump administration until new protocols were established for how migrants should be transported. But he had to back down just hours later, after the U.S. threatened to place 25% tariffs on Colombian exports. Trump described it as a win for U.S. diplomacy.
Everybody said that with Colombia, it was going to be a disaster. In one hour, everything was settled. You know why? Tariffs. Tariffs are very powerful, both economically and in getting everything else you want.
But some scholars say that using tariffs for political ends could backfire.
Right now, the United States looks like a more and more unreliable, erratic partner that is not interested in trade as a way of benefiting both countries' economies, but rather as a type of political weapon to get certain results on the ground in countries.
Will Freeman is a Latin America expert at the Council on Foreign Relations.
So I think that that'll make China look more and more like the adult in the room, the reliable partner, which you can at least count on to manage trade in a semi-normal way.
China has invested heavily in infrastructure projects in Latin America, like a massive port that was recently opened in Peru. And now it's also exploiting natural resources, like lithium mines. Some analysts, like Eric Farnsworth, say that the U.S. could lose out in this competition for natural resources if it doesn't win more hearts and minds in Latin America.
You know, first of all, we have to recognize the value of the region to ourselves, whether it's on, you know, our own economic growth, lower inflation, energy security, food security, all of these issues.
Farnsworth is the vice president of the Council of the Americas, a group that promotes U.S. investment in the Western Hemisphere.
It's not wrong for the Trump administration to want border security, to want to reduce fentanyl into the United States, to want to reduce and to regularize migration. The question is, can you do that in isolation, or do you need hemispheric and regional partners to help you achieve those goals.
As the threat of trade wars looms, the deportation flights continue. But the actual number of flights hasn't increased, says Tom Cartwright. He heads Witness at the Border, an organization that tracks deportation flights.
In January, for the full month, there were basically 5 deportations, you know, on average, on weekdays that weren't holidays, down from 6 in December, tied for the second lowest level in at least the last 2 years.
However, the conditions on some of the flights have become tougher, with the Trump administration now flying some migrants in military cargo planes instead of using civilian aircraft.
And the reason I think that they're doing that is to really kind of dehumanize the situation, basically to underpin the very specious assertion that we're under an invasion. And if you're under an invasion, how do you stop an invasion? You stop it with the military.
Using military planes could make Trump look like he's being tough on illegal immigration, but it could also lead to resentment in Latin American countries that are considering whether it's better to do business with China or with the United States. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Bogota.
And now we've got a few updates on stories we've been covering this week.
After a mass shooting in Sweden, the country is reforming its gun laws. New legislation will restrict access to semi-automatic weapons, putting more checks on who can own them. Hunting is popular in Sweden, but in remarks today, Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson said we have to ensure that only the right people have guns in Sweden.
Also today, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei suggested that he does not plan to resume nuclear weapons talks with the U.S. President Donald Trump had floated the idea of a nuclear peace agreement with Tehran earlier in the week. Khamenei noted that Trump pulled the U.S. out of the last agreement. The Americans did not uphold their end of the deal, he said, adding, "This is an experience we must learn from."
And a former interpreter for Japanese baseball star Shohei Ohtani has been sentenced to nearly 5 years in jail. He pled guilty to stealing nearly $17 million from Ohtani. The interpreter, Ipe Mezuhara, was trying to pay off gambling debts. In court yesterday, he said he was truly and deeply sorry for what he had done and that he accepted his punishment.
And those are some updates on stories we've been following. When the big game starts in New Orleans on Sunday, the NFL is hoping to have more international eyes on the gridiron than ever before. In recent years, the league has been focused on marketing the sport around the world, looking to pick up fans in Europe and South America. One place where American football already has some traction is Japan. Kai Dumbach attended a recent championship game there.
It's just after New Year's at the Tokyo Dome, home to the Yomiuri Giants, Japan's version of the New York Yankees. But something feels a little different. Okay, more than a little different. There's a field goal post at home plate and another in deep center field. But there will be no long fly balls today, as it's the Rice Bowl. This is the championship for Japan's X-League, which is one of the world's top football leagues outside of North America. The Fujitsu Frontiers are taking on the Panasonic Impulse for the fourth year in a row. The game kicks off. It has a similar feel to the game in the US. There are touchdowns, cheerleaders, and even a halftime show at midfield. While the majority of the players are Japanese, each team in the league is allowed 4 American players. So for those who couldn't quite make it to the NFL or the Canadian Football League up north, this is the perfect option.
It just came out of nowhere, to be honest. It was a surprise. I didn't expect.
Jabari Williams was a standout linebacker at Wake Forest who was signed by the Philadelphia Eagles but just couldn't make it happen at the biggest stage. When he felt his playing days were at an end, he managed to find his way to the Impulse on the other side of the Pacific Ocean.
I've been living my life. I love Japan. I love my teammates. I love everyone. Japan is so peaceful, so just dope. It's dope as hell to be out here.
His teammate and fellow American, defensive back Joshua Cox, agrees and has felt welcome since day one. They always ask him about football in the U.S.
They're very open-minded. Like, I could teach a lot of technique stuff that I've learned in America that they might not get over here, and they don't hesitate to ask.
But what's rather odd is that even though the level of play has shot up in recent years, attendance has fallen off. Before COVID, the league championship game would typically draw about 25,000 people. This year, not even 20,000 showed up. How can this be? John Gunning, a longtime sports reporter in Japan, knows why.
Off the field, the problem is because it's not a professional sport, like the people who are running it, most of the people running it are also part-time amateurs. A lot of them are like former players as well. So you have the issue of people who don't have like very solid business plans. And it being Japan, you need consensus for everything.
That lack of professionalism keeps most games off the TV and makes it hard to find live coverage. But that certainly does not change the passion that the players have for the game, as former X-League linebacker Hideyuki Hata says.
The culture of American football had spread into Japan since 1934. It's been well taken care of from a niche area, but it's been really been valued throughout the history. So there's a uniqueness of the style, how it's approached, but the passion is the same.
Back at the championship, it's been a tight contest. With less than 5 minutes to go, the Impulse are up by a touchdown, but the Frontiers have the ball. Williams sees something. He's been pushed back almost all game, but now he can leap into greatness. Pass gets intercepted, taken away by Jabari Williams, and he'll go all the way for the touchdown.
So I knew I couldn't get to the quarterback. They had both the inside and the outside cut off, so I tried to get in the ball path, and he threw it, and my instincts kicked in, and my hands went up, and I caught it.
Tears flowed from the players, cheerleaders, coaches, and fans' faces after the game. Joy for the Impulse and an agony for the Frontiers. The players addressed their fans, and the coaches gave one last speech to their men. And there's only one thing left to do when you beat your arch nemesis in the championship game for the first time in 4 years.
I'm gonna get drunk as hell.
It may not be the Super Bowl, but it's certainly their Super Bowl. For The World, I'm Kai Dombach, Tokyo.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. There's a scene in Finding Nemo where Dory, a fish, tries to ask a whale for directions, and she runs into a language barrier.
Whale. Okay. Maybe he only speaks whale.
We need
Dory.
To find
what are you doing? What are you doing?
The whale just swims away.
Maybe a different dialect. Maybe I should try humpback.
No, don't try humpback.
Whoa!
All right.
Whoa!
You actually sound sick.
Still no dice. Obviously, Dory is no scholar of maritime linguistics, but those do kind of exist. Marine biologists have been studying whale song for decades. And in a recent paper published in the journal Science, some teamed up with linguists and made a fascinating discovery.
Turns out the songs of whales use a structure that's found at the core of every human language. It's called the ZIF distribution, and it refers to how frequently words appear in any given language.
The second most common word in a language is used half as frequently as the most common word. The third most common word appears one-third as often as the most common word, and so on. You get the idea.
The ZIF distribution phenomenon plays a key role in helping language pass from one generation to the next, and so it does with whales, too. The discovery was made by studying 8 years' worth of humpback whale recordings and comparing them to the early speech development of humans. What emerged were some interesting similarities.
Whale songs, like human speech, are culturally learned, meaning a whale learns a song from the other whales it spends time with, and so, just like humans, they form distinct dialects.
This discovery does not mean we're on the cusp of learning how to speak whale. It's really new insight into the structure of whale song, not its actual content. Sorry, Dory. If you want to really sound like a humpback, here you go.
All right, from whale songs to a very human sing-along. That is the spirit behind Germany's Rudelsingen. They're concerts where the audience is also the main act. The name comes from the German word Rudel, or a wolf pack. Reporter Valerie Hamilton has this story from a Rudelsingen in Munich.
The point of Rudelsingen is that everyone sings. Audience participation is the main act, actually the only act. Sometimes there's a band playing the songs. Sometimes, like tonight, it's just an MC with a playlist and some big speakers. But the music is going to be drowned out by the 200 people here who can't wait to open those pipes.
99 Luftballons auf ihrem Weg zum Horizont.
Like Sabina and her friend Monica, they're veteran Rudel singers. The last time they did this, they were in a circus tent with 1,000 other people. Tonight, it's a converted post office. Next time, the lobby of the symphony.
Singing is fun. Singing is fun.
Mia Hansen is doing this for the first time. I asked her, what's the appeal of singing in a wolf pack with hundreds of strangers?
Well, you can't hear your own voice. So that's good. And I guess just enjoying the vibe with everybody else and, like, yeah, not being embarrassed to sing. I think that's maybe part of it.
Ladies and gentlemen, sing in double tap.
The MCs tell the singers this is an embarrassment-free zone. There are no wrong notes. Your job is to be loud and have fun.
So I'm excited for that.
And then it's showtime. The lyrics are projected on big screens, so people don't have to know the words. It's like giant karaoke without the judgment, like a choir without the practice. And it sounds okay. Mostly.
We have a very much divide in the society, those who can and those who cannot and those who try and those who fail.
Günter Kreutz is a professor of music psychology at the University of Oldenburg. I reached out to him to try to understand why Rudelsingen is so popular.
You could call it a spiritual need.
Singing together, he said, makes people feel part of something bigger. A pack, maybe. Germany has a long cultural history of group singing, starting with men's choirs of the 1820s, which then became mixed choirs after the Second World War. Singing was an important part of community life, but times have changed. Choir membership has dropped by half in 10 years. Just 8% of Germans sing as a hobby. German culture is changing too. Now, says Kreutz, it's all about individual achievement, talent, success.
And of course, this produces pressure on people who say, oh, well, am I good enough to sing? Is my voice good enough? And the success of Rudelsingen is also a mirror image of our failure to educate people to take singing as something normal that they can integrate into their lives.
The first Rudelsingen was only about 15 years ago. Since then, it's taken off. Now there are sing-alongs all over the country, from big branded productions to one-offs at festivals or local theaters. On the same random Thursday they were hitting those high notes in Munich, Rudelsingers were singing country songs in the South.
Almost heaven, West Virginia.
And German pop hits up in the North. Every year, Germany's state music councils promote an instrument of the year. This year, it's the human voice. Hartmut Schröder heads the music council of the German state of Schleswig-Holstein.
We decided it's time to focus on this instrument and to see what everybody can do with it.
Back at the Rudelsingen, the wolf pack is howling away. I use the instrumental break to check in with Mia Hansen. She definitely does not sound embarrassed to sing.
It's going great. Yeah, my voice is already dead, but it's going great.
I ask her how everyone else is singing. And you know what? They are.
I've had the time of my life. No, I never felt this way before.
Never felt this way, I swear.
For The World, I'm Valerie Hamilton, Munich.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend and join us right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Mary Elizabeth Alexander, Sarah and Stephen Bass, Stephanie Fox and Drew Britcher, Deet and Paul Meserve, and Corey Zanin. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.